the reason why the gradual training is so important and really is the pearl of the Buddha's genius is because we think that things happen for no reason. In daily life, when negative things happen to us or good things happen to us, we don't stop to think about the participation of our own mind in events. When we sit in meditation or when we're at a retreat, many of us feel that meditation may happen, may not happen. We feel adrift at sea. And in the Christian tradition, whether or not we're going to make contact with something transcendent is often described as a matter of grace. Not so in Buddhism. Thank the Lord, not so in Buddhism. The backbone of the Buddha's teaching is cause and effect. This is often known as the teaching of cause and effect. The two main disciples of the Buddha, Mahamoggallana and Sariputta, reached the first stage of awakening stream entry just on hearing the Venerable Asaji's phrases to them. Of those things that have a cause, the Blessed One has declared, and also their cessation. The Venerable Asaji was one of the five monks that the Buddha had converted in the deer park at Isipatana. But just on hearing the declaration that all things arise from causes, and therefore all things cease when those causes are taken away, was enough to awaken the two main, or begin to awaken, the two main disciples of the Buddha, those pithy lines. That should declare to us the importance of cause and effect in the training. This is a technology. We think about reaching the unconditioned, something that is not fashioned, asankata, not put together, not fabricated. But the teaching itself is a fabrication. The teaching itself is conditioned. If we have the world, as it appears to us, the tangled skein, as the Buddha called it, of suffering, of aging, disease, and death, of pain. If this is the natural world where unfortunate things seem to happen to us because of various causes that are beyond our control and many causes that are within our control, if we have this tangled mass of causation in this world, the Buddha's teaching is a grid that's placed flat over that tangled skein of causation. We don't like to hear that because many of us who are attracted to the Buddha's teaching, attracted to Eastern spirituality, we want things to be more natural. We feel like through our technology, through our minds, we have somehow lost an innocence. We're a very romantic people. And so we want to get back to this point where we're not neurotic, where we're flowing with nature. And the Buddha had something to say about flowing with nature. If you go with the flow of nature, you go where every river leads, to the mudflats. This teaching is a construct, and the Buddha laid upon it the gradual training, the system of cause and effect, where we can escape aging, disease, suffering, and death. The basis of this construct is something that we call karma. And it is the basis of right view. Right view means right view of causation, karma. Karma vipaka, karma from the verb karoti, to do, to make, vipaka, resultant, action and resultant. The Buddha said that if an unwholesome state of mind arises, it has a cause. If an unwholesome state of mind ceases, it has a cause. If a wholesome state of mind arises, it has a cause. And if, through the practice of the training, a wholesome state of mind leads to the cessation of perception and feeling, that too has a cause. And that system of causation is very well encapsulated in the gradual training. The gradual training appears in many suttas, of course, in the Digha Nikaya, the first two are the most famous, the net of views where the Buddha goes through and dispels the wrong views that were in his time. But the next sutta, the Samanyapala Sutta, the fruits of the of recluseship of the spiritual life, in there, the Buddha identifies wrong view about causation. Many of us think that karma was something that the Buddha just accepted because it was in the spiritual context of Vedic India, that he was simply accepting the cultural trappings of his day. Not so. We know from Digha Nikaya number 2 that there were lots of ideas about causation. I'll read to you the 6. The first was advanced by Paranakasapa, and this is the doctrine of nihilism. And he said that one could essentially feed all living beings through a deli slicer, and there would be no resultant from that action. Complete nihilism. Actions have no resultant. And then there was Makali Gosala, contemporary of the Buddha, who said that all things were determined, that all beings had a measured out quantity of pleasure and pain, that bondage and liberation from the wheel of samsara or the plane of samsara, the existence, was predetermined. So we might think of the Calvinists in the Christian tradition who have this idea of predestination, determinism. And then we have the idea that I think most of us who would flatter ourselves to be scientifically minded people and sober and rational people, and this is materialism, that at the death of the body decomposes into the 4 primary elements, and that's it. There's no resultant. Good doers, evil doers, find their salvation in the earth. If that were the case, there would be no point in you sitting here right now. If that were the case, you are wasting your time in sitting here right now. If that were the case, enjoy and be merry, because there's nothing more than this. Another doctrine, which is popular today in other forms of Eastern thought and in other forms of Buddhism, is essentially a monistic idea that the world is set in a unity, and there's really nothing that can be done to change that unity. This is found in the Upanishads, very famously, if the slayer thinks he slays, or if the slain thinks he is slain, neither understand. It neither slays nor is slain. So there's a unity. Also found in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says to Arjuna, let your arrows fly on the battlefield, for I am Lord Krishna and I encompass you all. I encompass those you fight against. I encompass you. I encompass the entire universe. And every action in this universe is just happening within Krishna. So fulfill your dhamma, fulfill your role. That was another idea of causation in the Buddhist time. We have the eel wrigglers, the people who were essentially linguistically uncommitted. So they wouldn't say that something is, and they wouldn't say that something wasn't. They wouldn't be pinned down by words. And again, we can see that this idea is also fashionable in our time, where we distrust language. And again, this goes back to the romanticism of our culture, where the mute experience of nature is somehow closer to the divine than the articulations of the human mind. In this view, whatever comes up linguistically is denied, is simply negated. The Buddha rejected that idea as well. Finally, there was the doctrine of the Jains, of Nigantha Nataputta, and this was closest to the Buddha's ideas, but not quite. So the Jains thought that through action, we accumulated karma. We had a primordial state of purity, of unity, and through action, we had accreted particles, physical particles, called karma, onto ourselves, and that the job of the spiritual life was to get rid of those particles, to expiate those particles, those physical particles, generally through physical action, extreme fasting. The apex of the Jain practice was to fast to death, and that would be a way of somehow repaying the karmic debt freeing yourselves from these particles that are weighing down the soul. And the Buddha said, if that were the case, do you know how many particles are on you and how much purification will be needed to purify yourselves of your karma? And no one could answer. The Buddha actually said that karma begins in the mind. Karma, O monks, I declare, is intention. And so the movement of the mind is where this system of cause and effect begins. And this is why in the Buddha's teaching, right view is so important. If we aren't watching our mind and watching our intentions and realizing, if we do not guard our intentions, if we're not aware of our intentions, whether they're wholesome or unwholesome, whether we're with the object of meditation or not with the object of meditation, they will proliferate into action of body, into action of speech, into actions of mind. Now, in the beginning of the retreat, we're coming, of course, from the lay life, and the world is heavy with us. We are gross when we are in the lay life, not disgusting, but heavy. We're living the heaviest sort of life, right? Living the lay life, living the life of materiality, of sensuality, of meeting the demands of the world. If that is the mode that our mind functions in, the mind does not have the strength or the subtlety to be able to see intention clearly. And that is why we practice the moralities. That is why we practice guarding the senses. We are trying to break free from the gross activities of body, speech, and mind. And in so doing, we find that not only we break free from them, but we cultivate their opposites. This is stated very clearly in Book 11 of the Anguttara Nikaya, that if meditation is to arise, if the meditative factors are to arise, they don't arise from nowhere. They don't arise without a cause. The Buddha was asked, what is the purpose and the benefit of wholesome, virtuous behavior? And he answered to Ananda, the purpose and benefit of wholesome, virtuous behavior is non-regret, to not have the mind plagued by regret. And what, Bhante, is the purpose and benefit of non-regret? The purpose and benefit of non-regret is gladness, pamoja in Pali. What is the purpose and benefit of gladness? The purpose and benefit of gladness is rapture. Now, rapture is that point, piti in Pali, where we have entered into the meditative state. Prior to the arising of rapture, everything that we feel can be felt in our ordinary everyday lives. Maybe not so strongly, maybe not so clearly, but we've held puppies in our ordinary everyday lives and babies, and we felt deeply moved by something beautiful. We've felt love, even unconditional love at times, outside of the meditative context. And that feeling of metta, that feeling of love that we felt outside of the meditative context, corresponds to this pamoja, this gladness. But when we take that as an object of meditation, which we're doing in this retreat, and we allow our mind to be filled with it, rapture will arise. When rapture arises, we have arrived at the transcendent path. So let's look at the moralities and understand clearly what their value is. Because without them, we can't have non-regret. And without non-regret, we can't really perfect gladness. And without perfecting gladness, we can't have jhana. Of course, the first precept is not to kill and not to harm living beings on purpose. But if we cultivate this precept very closely, we will notice other living beings. And we will notice when we see them, let's take ants on the ground that we may be following along with our fingers or shooing away from our eating place. When the ant notices that there's another being, it starts running. It's afraid. It has craving to be. It wants to exist. It wants to be happy. It's not just an ant. It's like us. What do ants do in their time when they're not near us, right? They're always busy. They're always collecting things and building things. As one of my Tibetan teachers said, the ants are always in the busy. And we're like them. We're always in the busy. And when we see in a lower creature, like an ant or in any other animal, that they are like us, that is the stirring of compassion. They want to live just as we want to live. They want to be happy just as we want to be happy. In order to see that, we have to first give them the respect as a being and refrain from harming them. The second precept, of course, is to not take what is not given. If we cultivate that very strongly, we become aware of the sovereignty of other beings, that they're not there to serve our appetite, that they're not pawns in our life, that they're three-dimensional. We tend to think that we're the only being in the universe and everybody else is a kind of projection. We tend to think that on a very subtle level. But if we respect that other being and we don't take from them, we begin to see them in three dimensions. And then we see again that they're struggling just like we are, that they want to be happy just like we want to be happy, that they are seeking sensual fulfillment the way we, in our folly, are seeking sensual fulfillment. And we can be the being for them, especially if it's an animal. We can be generous with them, share our food, maybe even with them. I remember last time I was here, I was in Monterey, and there's this rock, and the chipmunks live in the little holes of the rock, and they've gotten used to tourists, but in my fantasy, maybe they hadn't gotten used to tourists. So I would go sit on the rock, and they would scurry away, and then I took a little piece of my sandwich, and slowly the chipmunk came out, took the piece of sandwich, ran back, ate the piece of sandwich, and then I did another piece of sandwich. Word got around, he brought friends. And they all sat and enjoyed my sandwich with me. And I thought to myself, these hungry beings, I was able to feed them. I was able to give them what they want. And they are looking at me as a threat. And now they're looking at me as a friend. What have I done with a living being at that point? As a human being, who can make an object of my own experience, who, unlike all other living beings that we know of, can make an object of our experience, make an object of our desires, and actually choose a wholesome direction. We are unique. This is the preciousness of human life. This creature saw me make that choice. And perhaps, this was the nudge that this being, who is in a lower realm, whose life is dominated by greed, whose life is dominated by fear, maybe this being, on some tiny level, was a little mystified that I was sharing the sandwich for no reason. Maybe that was the tiniest little push it needed upward. That's our generosity. This may all be fantasy, but you know, all of it's a construct. What does this fantasy do? This fantasy uplifts, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's true or not true, you know, if we get David Attenborough in there to really find out whether the chipmunk was stirred by my kindness, doesn't matter at all. That I think it was stirred by my kindness is what matters, because I then see myself as a being who has helped another being. This is the second precept turned into its opposite, turned into a virtue. The same thing with the third. The third precept about not committing sexual misconduct is really about not taking advantage of someone, especially someone's feelings, someone who might be in an inferior position or in a place of weakness relative to you, not exploiting others for your pleasure. And we can see that as well. The more respect that we develop for all living beings, animals, for each other, the more other beings fill in three dimensions. And the more a natural disgust arises within us that we might do anything to violate the sovereignty and the happiness of other living beings. We would feel regretful, and that would be to our downfall. That would place us far from jhana. That would corrupt our minds. And so, as an act of protecting our own minds, as an act of opening up and feeling these wonderful transcendent feelings, we give the sovereignty, we experience the sovereignty of other beings. We don't exploit them. We support them. We help them. We're kind to them where we can be. And of course, the last precept has to do with being false. If you're here on retreat, I'm assuming that you're genuinely interested in the spiritual path, because there's no other being that can give you the experience that you might get through your meditation. There's no other being that can liberate you from your suffering. So it's very important in cultivating right speech to be honest with yourself about where you are on the path. It says in the suttas that a monk who is committed to virtue trembles at the slightest fault. Trembling at the slightest fault means that we understand clearly that the Buddha's teaching on causation is true. There are three ways of reckoning a spiritual teaching. One, we think it over and it appears rational to us. Well, we do that all day. That's up here. That's in this brain that has developed over time behind the place where we eat and the sense organs to locate food, to sort of strategize and find where to get food and find advantageous situation. It is also in the human being allowed us to step back and make an object of experience. It's a wonderful part of the brain. But the place that accepts spiritual truth, the place that becomes wise, isn't in the brain, isn't in rationalizing. The Buddha actually calls that a form of hearsay, that it seems to make sense based upon logical propositions. It's not one's firsthand experience at that point. It becomes firsthand experience when one accepts something in the heart. And so the second step of reckoning with a spiritual truth is by inference, by intuitive inference. For instance, we hear the phrase, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. The truth of that statement isn't just in its words. There's something in addition to that statement that opens the heart. Now, we, of course, have not gone through the entire world and poked out everybody's eyes. That has not been our experience. But the inference from that statement is that hatred is never appeased by hatred. Hatred is only appeased by love. So the last form and the highest form of reckoning a spiritual truth is through our practice and having direct experience of it. This is what we can gain from the moralities. If we keep the precepts and we cultivate their opposites, we see that our mind is light. We see that our mind is wieldy and flexible. We see that our mind easily attains to wholesome states, to states even of jhana. And that is proof, direct proof within ourselves that the teaching of cause and effect is true. And when we have that direct experience of the truth of the Buddha's teaching for ourselves, that is the basis of great faith in the teaching, great trust. And we finally found this solution that we've been looking for. Nothing seems trustworthy in this world. Everything seems to be falling apart because everything is falling apart. But if we have the Dhamma and we've experienced the truth of the Dhamma, our trust need not fall apart. It's the one thing that is our refuge and our protection. That's why we take refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. The Buddha is physically not with us anymore. So there's no Buddha physically here to take refuge in. The Sangha perpetuates the teaching, and that is our great gratitude to take refuge in them. But the Dhamma and the direct experience of the Dhamma and the awakening of faith and the awakening of confidence that happens on the basis of our direct experience is our shelter, is our refuge. And so I would invite you to look closely at your mind in practicing the precepts. See what's happening. See your mind opening as you experience not only refraining from poor conduct, but engaging in virtuous conduct, helping, being beneficial, being generous, protecting others, seeing the sovereignty of others, admiring the truth of the Dhamma. This is the basis of joy and the basis of your good meditation. Are there any questions on the moralities or on the meditation or on right view?
It's more a curiosity than anything. So where does the free will come in then, in the sense that you make choices?
The free will comes in with, again, the unique human ability to make an object of our experience. So beings that can't objectify their experience, objectify the sense bases and the data that comes in through the sense bases, have no ability to choose their response to what comes in at the sense bases. So at feeling, when feeling occurs, so we have six sense bases and contact is made and feeling arises. Right then and there, if we let go of the feeling, craving will not arise. That's our free will. Our space of free will is between feeling and craving. Once we've craved, we've given away what measure of free will that we have.
So craving is actually an action. It's already out there and in motion. It can't be retracted.
It will have its resultant, right? So craving is an intention, and that will have its vipaka resultant. It doesn't mean that we can't catch the next contact, but if we don't intervene between feeling and craving and we allow the craving to be there, it will slightly darken our mindset. And our mindset, and here I'm referring to citta, again, not this brain thing that is a warehouse of information that's going to go in the ground and decompose, right? And we're probably going to forget everything in the brain well before that happens, and good riddance to it. Who needs to remember their social security number? But this, located in Eastern religions, in the heart center, this is what goes on, the state of emotion. This is what becomes reborn, and it's constantly changing. If we don't guard our senses and we don't intervene between feeling and craving, it affects the level on which the citta, I hate to use this new age term, vibrates. It just darkens our mood ever so slightly. And we need the elevated citta in order to experience expanded states of mind. So I'll leave you to think on that, and we'll talk about the sense restraint. The sense restraint, again, is something that is important to this practice because we have this habit when we are not guarding our senses of fastening on to what are called the signs and features. So there's nothing wrong with walking around on a path and keeping your eyes open so you don't trip and hurt yourself. But if you stop and you analyze a particular aspect of what you're doing, that is an invitation for, I like it, I don't like it, craving. So the practice, the good practice of guarding the senses is when you're out and about to keep your eyes down. Where the eyes are, there's the soul. So keep your eyes down, say about four to 6 feet in front of you, just so you don't crash into something. avoiding eye contact with people as a measure of our noble silence, because when we make eye contact with people, we are trying to communicate with them. Wonderful. It's usually a good idea to make eye contact with people. But when we're in this retreat setting, we should not be making eye contact with people. Again, the mind tends to pick out what it likes and what it doesn't like, and the faces of others and the expression of others. And others may not even be thinking of us, or probably are not. And there's an expression on their face that has entirely to do with their own inner state of mind. And then we see that and we think, did I do something to that person? So we need to avoid all that kind of mistake and confusion and drama, and keep our eyes down. Eat, don't relish, just eat. Drink when you need to drink. Take food for the sustaining of the body, but not for pleasure and amusement. Sleep as much as we need, but don't relish in the sleeping, taking pleasure in the sleeping. Your pleasure should come from the object of meditation, because it will lead to an otherworldly pleasure, a liberating pleasure. We'll talk about this, but the Buddha did say of sensual pleasures that these pleasures are to be feared, that they are not to be followed, that they are a danger, danger taking us off the path. But he said of the pleasure of the jhanas, this is a pleasure not to be feared. This is a pleasure to be pursued. This is a liberating pleasure, the bliss of nibbana. So we want our pleasure and our fulfillment to come from the meditation and not from other sources. Yes, this is mindfulness. You're getting joy from your mindfulness. You're recollecting. Mindfulness, I think, is best translated not as just awareness, but recollection. So you're bringing something to mind that is wholesome in order to feel the warmth, the sensation of metta in your chest. And then you drop whatever it is that provokes that sensation and just feel the sensation. The wholesome. Yes. Wholesome.
I was hoping you could clarify around the chipmunks. There are a lot of good intentions not informed by wisdom that cause a lot of harm. And I was thinking about what you said about the truth of the impact not mattering.
Certainly, if you know that you're doing a creature a harm by engaging in an activity, right? That's part of how karma is made, is to intend an activity for the detriment of a creature or of another being. Bad karma is not made if your intentions are good. Worldly consequences that are negative can happen if your intentions are good or bad. So one could also say that we have allowed medical technology to spread to the whole world, increasing people's lifespans and survival, but now we've got to feed everybody, and now we've got to house everybody. And so what began as a good intention may have had unintended consequences, and so we have to follow through. There's a Chinese proverb about a farmer who brought back a wild horse to his farm, And all the neighbors said, what great luck. You found a wild horse. And the farmer said, maybe. And the farmer's son went to tame this wild horse and fell from the wild horse and broke his leg, I think. And everybody said, oh, what rotten luck. And the farmer said, maybe. And then the next day, the conscription officer from the Imperial Army came by to conscript the son, and they couldn't take him because he had a broken leg. And they said, what good fortune. And the farmer said, maybe. So we don't know what the worldly resultants of all of our actions can be, but if we do know them, if we do know what the results of our actions are, and the results of our actions are negative, and we still do them anyway, well, then we're making bad karma. Yeah. Does that answer your question? It's not a, unfortunately, the Dhamma is not, probably not going to be compatible with the movement. I'm a history major, revisionist history, right? So what appeared to be good in the past turns out to have been a horrible thing. As we become wiser, more aware of others, more appreciative of the sovereignty of others, certainly. Yeah. It's only about right now in this moment. Do you know that it's good? Is this genuinely for the benefit of others? If so, do it. Is this harming others? If you know that it's harming others, don't do it. Again, the Dhamma is artificial in a certain respect, because in the worldly life, lines of causation are tangled and multifaceted. But the Dhamma limits causation and karma to one's intention and one's action, direct action based on that intention. Okay. Put your attention on your breath for just a few moments. Become aware of the depth of your out-breath. Really allow your stomach to fill with air and feel the ease of your stomach slowly and thoroughly emptying of air. Feel the shoulders drop as you exhale. Feel the chest becoming light and open. Any anxiety, worry, tension we might feel in the chest, let the breath massage that away. Now become aware of your heart center, a place of warmth if you feel metta, a place of spaciousness. Right in the center of your chest. Think of a time when you helped a living being that was in trouble. It could be a person, an animal, maybe an insect that you caught in your home. become aware of the worry and the fear and that being. The desire to live in its eyes. Recognize that all beings want to live just as you want to live. Recognize that all beings are anxious for their lives and their happiness. Now recognize the great blessing, the great ease, the great relief you brought to that being by helping them. See their happiness. Rejoice that you were the cause of that happiness. Now recall a time when you shared your possessions with another being. Maybe your money, your material items, your time, your ear. All beings want to feel special and appreciated. And you gave these feelings to that being. See their joy at being seen and loved by you. Allow your own heart to overflow with their joy. Now think of a time when you put the happiness of another ahead of your own. Taking care of a child, an aging parent, a sick person. Recognize that you took care of them when they needed protection. Feel the sense of decency and accomplishment that you were their rock, their champion. Let your heart swell at the blessing that you were or have been to this person. Now recall a time when you brought two people who were angry back together. You knew just what to say to put both people at ease. Recognize that your careful and well-timed words transformed hatred and bitterness into forgiveness and joy. May all beings recognize and rejoice in their own purity.